This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Right now, almost all attention in the Gaza conflict is focused on big decisions to be taken in Jerusalem or Tehran. But it all began 6 months ago when Hamas launched its attack on Israel. And sometimes the organisation seems like McCavity the cat. Hamas spokespeople don't speak, its losses aren't given in the Gaza casualty figures, and few in Gaza ever seem to have seen its fighters. What happens when we bring it back into the spotlight? And what do we know about the state of Hamas half a year into this bloody war? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what have we learned more recently about Hamas's planning and intentions for the October 7th attack and its calculations about what would happen afterwards? Jennifer Jeffries is a teaching professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies program and author of Hamas, Terrorism, Governance and Its Future in Middle East Politics. Jennifer Jeffries, what have we learned in the last 6 months about the October 7th attack?
So I would say there's three main things. First, Hamas was more military capable than I think we previously believed. They conducted a full-scale military operation on October 7th. They planned it, they practiced it, and they executed it with devastating results. Second, then I would say Hamas is more open to pragmatic collaboration than I had previously understood. We now know that for years they'd been running military-like training exercises with numerous other armed groups in Gaza. And these groups were spread across the ideological spectrum. Looking at how Hamas had accepted money from Iran in the past, but then was prepared to give up that source of funding when they faced ideological differences, or how they'd repeatedly dabbled in the idea of unity governments with Fatah only to pull out at the last minute, led me to think originally that their specific religious ideology was the primary driver of their partnerships. But I think October 7th has taught me that this is not the case. The primary driver is the creation of an Islamic Palestinian state, and I think they'll align their remaining priorities accordingly. And then finally, how wildly different Israel and Hamas fight, and then the respective advantages those different methods give them. So Israel is a powerful traditional warfighter. It has the equipment, the strategic knowledge, and the training to identify and destroy targets. But what they're not good at is fighting the war for public opinion. And in this day and age, that matters more than I think they plan for. And then in contrast, Hamas, while certainly weakened by Israel's superior hard power capabilities, they haven't let up on their efforts to demolish Israel in the eye of the global public. So they acknowledge hits when they can point to civilian casualties, but are quiet when it comes to the death of their own fighters. They're quick to blame Israel for any dramatic misfires, whether they come from Israel or not. And then they have, I would almost say that they have Israel sort of on their public relations heels, so to speak. And it has ramifications for Israel's status in the global community.
Now, we imagine, of course, that the attack was planned for a very long time. What do we now understand to have been the desired goal of the attack on October the 7th? What were they trying to do?
I mean, in some sense, I don't know that we're going to know this. Certainly not now, maybe ever. But I think we can kind of make an educated guess, at least based on what we know about the organization. And I consistently think of Hamas as a three-sided organization, right? It's religious, it's nationalist, and it's violent. And when we think of desired goals according to these categories, I think it helps sort of sort out what they may have been thinking. As a religious organization that believes that paradise is the reward for those killed in pursuit of an Islamic state, even death is not a terrible outcome. Martyrdom can actually be a goal in and of itself. And then as a group with nationalist ambitions, There's little question that the October 7th attacks have raised the Palestinian cause to a higher level of global consciousness than it had been in some time. Hamas had rightly feared that this consciousness had been lost, or at least certainly on the decline, particularly in Arab states with the continued expansion of the Abraham Accords. And the attacks have really weakened and continue to weaken who Hamas sees as the primary obstacle to this Palestinian state, which of course is Israel. Israel's response in Gaza has drawn increased attention to issues of Israeli treatment of Palestinians more broadly, has undercut Netanyahu's right-wing coalition, provoked calls for a new election, called into question the ability of Netanyahu's government to keep Israel secure, and has challenged the government's global credibility. So Israel's reaction to Hamas's attack has put significant pressure on the relationship between Israel and the United States. And this plays really beautifully, I think, into Hamas's nationalist ambitions. And then finally, Hamas is violent. The actions taken on October 7th were terrifying, not just to those who experienced the violence firsthand, but to the families who continue to mourn their loss or agonize over their status as hostages. And then we have to remember that Hamas videoed their violence because they wanted Israelis to see what they were capable of and that they were a force to be reckoned with. So I suppose the answer to did Hamas know with certainty that all three elements of their identity would benefit from what happened on October 7th is, I don't know. And again, I'm not sure that we ever will, but I'm doubtful they anticipated all of this. And they've certainly incurred enormous costs. But I would also say that in light of sort of that three-edged organization that they are not losing the war.
Jennifer Jeffries. Now I want to find out what's happened to Hamas's military capability in the last 6 months. Michael Clark is Professor of Defence Studies and Specialist Advisor to the Joint Committee on the National Security Strategy. Michael Clark, what do we know about the size of Hamas's military might pre-October the 7th? And you can maybe also tell us what we mean by a military when it comes to Hamas.
Yes, I mean, Hamas was said by the Israeli Defense Forces to consist of about 30,000 fighters. But that's a fairly flexible number because, of course, a lot of people would be a car mechanic during the week and then turn out with an AK-47 occasionally when the mood took them. So the figure was always a bit of an order of magnitude guess. But this figure of 30,000 has been the one that the Israelis have stuck to, by which I think they mean 30,000 people who are paid by Hamas to do Hamas's job most of the time. They structure themselves as a formal military force. They have brigades, they have battalions. But below that level, really, they were a terrorist group working in cells. They worked in groups of fours and fives. They don't work in companies of 120. They structured themselves in brigades and battalions really for geographical purposes. So some brigades were responsible for the north, some brigades were responsible for the south, and the battalions were really a way of creating an authority structure. So if one person was killed, another person would automatically move up into that rank.
Do we have any idea of how many casualties Hamas has taken since October the 7th?
Well, interestingly, Hamas have admitted to about 6,000 out of the, let's guess, 30,000 that they began with. The Israelis say that Hamas lost 1,000 people on October the 7th and 8th and 9th in the first attacks, and they've lost 12,000 since. So the Israelis say 13,000 have been lost. That's a bit hard to square with the total casualty numbers, given that about 75% of the total casualties are women and children, and it looks as if, according to Hamas, 33,000 people have been killed within the whole operation. So the idea that the Israelis have actually killed 13,000 is probably a bit too high. On the other hand, in terms of people they've incapacitated, then they have to estimate, well, how many people may have been incapacitated with wounds? Because generally speaking, the wounded in most battles turn out to be about twice the number of dead, sometimes three times that number. So the Israelis may be there or thereabouts if they say they think they have incapacitated perhaps three quarters of the total number of Hamas fighters that they were facing. But these really are orders of magnitude rather than key figures themselves.
But even if that were even remotely close, that would be a really significant proportion of the fighters available to Hamas.
Yes, it would. And the Israelis say that they think there's four battalions worth left who are functioning, four to five battalions, and that would equate to maybe 3,000 of hardline Hamas fighters who they think are still to be engaged in some way. But these are not terribly reliable numbers, but undoubtedly Hamas will have lost a lot of people.
Do we know anything about where those fighters are now?
The fighters that we know are still available are in the Rafah Brigade, who are the ones in the south. The Rafah Brigade seems to be up and running with about four battalions attached to it. But Hamas have demonstrated an ability still to infiltrate north of Wadi Gaza, which is the watercourse where it cuts Gaza in half, south of Gaza City. And they've certainly been able to penetrate north of that. And the Israelis have admitted that they were still doing mopping up operations, even in the far north, until a couple of weeks ago. So some groups of fighters with weapons have been able to continue to operate through other parts of Gaza. But we assume that most of the existing Hamas people who are available to fight are probably based in Rafah.
Have Hamas lost senior military figures during the course of this battle? And does it matter?
Yes, they have. And yes, it matters to some degree. The Israelis have published a list, or have a list, of 113 individuals that they say are senior commanders that they have accounted for, i.e. mainly killed. And most of those 113 were killed between October and December. Then there were not many after that. Although they think that they have accounted for about 70 or 80% of the most senior people, they know that the way Hamas are structured, somebody else will step up into those shoes.
Now, of course, it's not possible to get a briefing from Hamas on their military strategy. So one, I imagine, just has to guess what their current military strategy is and what their objectives are. What would be your guesses?
Play for time. Let the world community bring pressure to bear on Israel, whose strategy has not been very clever from the very beginning of this crisis, and be there at the end of it. I mean, I think Hamas understand that they may have made a big mistake on the 7th of October because the attack that they conducted was far bigger and more traumatizing than they really expected it to be. And I think that they thought, somewhat unrealistically, that they could trigger and catalyze the final battle against Israel through this attack. And that hasn't happened. Hamas's victory is simply to be there at the end of this process. And at the moment, it looks as if they will be. So waiting it out, showing that they're still in existence in some form and that they cannot be snuffed out either as a military organization or as a political idea, that for them, I think, is victory.
It's, as we know, impossible to kill a political idea entirely, but it's not impossible to destroy a military. Is it realistic to think that there is any strategy which can destroy Hamas militarily, which is also feasible politically?
The strategy that would destroy Hamas militarily would be one that also puts something else in place in Gaza. So you've got to get onto the politics of it immediately, which means creating some sort of new authority in Gaza, which controls the police, controls the security, and is not Israeli, which then effectively isolates Hamas and then conduct quite a long campaign to snuff out Hamas, but snuffing it out because there is something better in its place that represents the 2.3 million people of Gaza. And that can only be done, of course, if the Palestinian question more generally, including the West Bank and Palestinian rights, all of that is now back on the table. So if some sort of political roadmap can now be created, then that part of it which applies to Gaza can have the effect of snuffing out the military capabilities that Hamas will continue to have when the fighting actually stops.
Michael Clark. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about how technology is changing warfare, the one about the dangers of synthetic opioids, and the one asking whether we could rejoin the EU even if we wanted to. Back to Hamas. The consequence of the October 7th attack and the Israeli response has been a humanitarian catastrophe for Palestinians. How has that impacted on support for Hamas in Gaza and on the West Bank? Khalil Shikaki is director of the Palestinian Centre for Policy and Survey Research in Jerusalem, and his team conducted polls in Gaza and the West Bank in December 2023 and March this year. Khalil Shikaki, how do you carry out your polls?
All of our surveys are conducted face-to-face in people's homes. In the case of the Gaza Strip this time, most of the interviews are conducted in shelters with people who have moved out of their homes and have gone to regular and irregular shelters So it was a little bit more difficult than usual. We interviewed 750 individuals in the Gaza Strip and a little over 800 in the West Bank.
Khalil, I'm bound to ask you, because I'm sure listeners will wonder, isn't conducting face-to-face polls in Gaza a risky business?
It is. Safety of our data collectors, of course, was important for us. And therefore, we only deployed our data collectors in areas that did not witness active combat. Luckily, nothing happened throughout the process of data collection. All of our data collectors are safe.
That's good to hear. Can I start by asking you this? We've heard a lot about the deaths of Palestinian civilians over the last 6 months. What did you find out about the scale of that?
So almost 80% of the Gazans have had one member of the family killed or injured, at least one member.
And how did people apportion blame for those deaths and injuries?
So the blame was clearly put on the Israelis. The overwhelming majority of the Palestinians does not believe that Hamas has committed atrocities on October the 7th. And so the blame is essentially being put by the overwhelming majority on the Israeli side.
Khalil, when you say that the significant majority don't believe that there were atrocities committed by Hamas on October the 7th, can you speculate as to whether or not that is just a matter of plain belief, or if it's a matter of what they've seen on their screens, i.e. videos from that day, or what they've been told by friends?
It depends on the sources of information they have, because we ask people, why haven't you seen videos? And the answer was essentially that the media they watched did not show. There is a small percentage, about 20%, said they just did not want to see those videos. This 20% is essentially admitting that it is in denial, that it does not want to watch. Now, this is very important. People who did watch were a lot more opposed to what happened on October the 7th. They were less willing to support Hamas as a political party. They were less willing to support continued Hamas control over Gaza. So this issue of whether Hamas did or did not commit atrocities is central to how people think about Hamas and whether they would or would not vote for it, or whether they wanted to stay in control.
Does it follow from that, given what you've just said, that the majority of respondents or a plurality of respondents say they still want Hamas to rule Gaza after the war?
Indeed. The majority does want Hamas to stay in control. However, this is not due to the fact that a majority would support Hamas if elections are held today, but simply because of the choices we offer them. The choices were essentially between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. And even those who are strongly opposed to Hamas prefer Hamas over the Palestinian Authority. The credibility, legitimacy of the Palestinian Authority is at its minimum. We've never seen it as low as it is today. If we gave people the choice of having elections and having an elected government or a national unity government, which we did, by the way, in the first survey after the war. In the second case, we did not. And so clearly, when the choice was just between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, people preferred Hamas. A slim majority in Gaza did say that it would prefer Hamas.
Khalil, amongst Gazans, has the attack on October the 7th made Hamas more or less popular?
The two surveys we've done indicated first that in the first survey, there was really no change, almost no change. There was a slight increase within the margin of error in support of Hamas in Gaza. The second survey, however, did show that almost a quarter of those who supported Hamas in the first survey no longer supported Hamas in the second survey. This might have to do with the fact that the second survey was done without a ceasefire in place and without hostage release during the data collection period. And it might also have to do with the fact that suffering of Gazans have perhaps led during the interval to greater number of Gazans to become disappointed with Hamas.
Let's just look up for a moment at what people think will happen with the current war. Do people have a concept of victory in the war? And if so, who do they think is going to achieve the victory in this war?
The first question is difficult to answer. We did not ask directly about this. My speculation would be that the survival of Hamas would be considered victory, even if the entire Gaza Strip is completely destroyed. This seems to me to be how Palestinians in both Gaza and the West Bank would define victory. And in that respect, when we ask people who is likely to emerge victorious, it was very clear that more people think Hamas would emerge victorious than Israel, although the majority was smaller than it was in December, first time we, after the war, we asked this question.
Let's look at that inevitable longer-term question, which is how this has affected Palestinian support or otherwise for the idea of a two-state solution. What can we say has happened to Palestinian opinion during the since October the 7th on that question?
In the first couple of months after the war, we did not really see any change, no decline in support for the two-state solution, which was low to begin with. It was about a third. But in the second survey we did, things have actually changed. In the Gaza Strip in particular, we've seen a rise in support for the two-state solution in the Gaza Strip, increasing from about one-third to 45% in March. So this is a significant increase, more than 10 percentage points. So it seems Gazans are beginning to see in the two-state solution the sort of guarantee for future survival as a nation.
Khalil Shikaki. And finally, I want to find out about the hostages and the negotiations for their release, a release that might hold the key to a ceasefire. Gershon Baskin is a former Israeli negotiator with Hamas, now director of Middle East operations for the UK-based NGO, the International Communities Organization. Gershon Baskin, can you remind us how many hostages did Hamas take on October 7th? And actually, were they all taken by Hamas?
There were about 250 hostages taken. Not all of them were Israelis, and not all of them were taken by Hamas. On October 7th, more than 3,000 people from Gaza crossed into Israel over the Gaza-Israel border. The bulk of the force were from the Hamas elite military unit called the Nukba Force, but there were also troops from Islamic Jihad, from the Popular Front, and other factions, as well as civilians who came over to pillage homes and burn them and kill people as well. And then they were taken into Gaza, and not all the hostages were held by Hamas either. It took a while before Hamas was able to get an accounting on who was where.
Now, was one of the objectives of the attack specifically to take hostages? And if so, why?
Apparently it was, from the papers and intelligence that's been collected. And the reason was because this is the way that they know how to free Palestinian prisoners from Israeli prisons. At the time of the October 7th attack, there were about 6,000 Palestinians in prison, including 559 of them serving life sentences for killing Israel. And Sinwar, who's the leader of Hamas in Gaza, was freed in the Shalit Exchange in 2011, and he promised his comrades that he would free them all.
So that was clearly a major part of the objectives of the attacks. Now, you've given us a number on the number of hostages being held, and we can assume, I think, from what you said, that the bulk of them being held by Hamas. How many have been returned since October the 7th? How many have died, and how many are still being held?
About half of them were returned, including non-Israelis, women and children in the first round in the end of November. There are still 133 hostages being held. According to Israeli official figures, about 34 of them are dead. Unofficial figures in the last weeks coming from Hamas and others was talking about 70 of them being dead. In the last 2 days, some people in Hamas have said that only about 40 of them remain alive from the 133.
Wow. So actually, we might be dealing with a situation whereby the bulk of the hostages who are assumed to be still in Gaza are actually not alive anymore.
Right. We really don't know because Hamas doesn't provide any information about the well-being of the hostages, if they're alive or dead. They have made claims about some of the hostages being killed. They've shown videos of hostages who were alive and then they showed their bodies. But we don't know. And we don't know if that's psychological warfare or if they're in fact dead. But I think it's likely to assume that many of them were killed by Israeli bombings and many of them may have been executed by Hamas or the other people who are holding them.
One would have thought that given the use of interlocutors in this process, such as Qatar, that Hamas would tell, let's say, the Qataris how many of these hostages are still alive. But from what you're saying, that doesn't seem to be the case.
They don't do that. That's not their mode of operation. They don't provide information. When they did provide information on the past, there was usually a price tag to it.
Right, okay. Which means that you're negotiating partially blindly.
Definitely. Negotiating blindly, negotiating in a situation where the two parties don't talk to each other, where the two parties are committed to killing each other, to eliminating each other, and have to go through third parties, such as the Egyptians and the Qataris, who also have their own interests, their own relations, and their own abilities in doing this job.
You paint a very grim picture, but let's just go back to the question of what may be demanded in return for the release of the hostages and what's happened so far. So if you could remind us, what was the price paid for the return of the hostages returned so far?
The hostages that returned so far were, the price tag was a ceasefire, which was initially for 5 days and extended for two more days. The price tag in terms of prisoners was for every Israeli hostage, and here we're talking about women and children. Three Palestinian prisoners were released, also women and teenagers from Israeli prison. That was the price tag. That was the low-hanging fruit. That was the deal that was easy to do because there was a limited small number of women and teenage prisoners in Israel. None of them were from Hamas, important people in Hamas. They were all from the West Bank and East Jerusalem, none from Gaza. And also Hamas logistically dealing with all the women and children that they were holding was a nightmare. And I assume that they didn't initially plan to take women and children hostages.
Right. Okay. So when we're talking about the negotiations that are currently taking place for the hostage release, the picture you're painting is that there may be relatively few live hostages left, but we just don't know, and that Hamas are asking for significant releases against that number. Now, can you just clarify something for me? Does Hamas insist on prisoner exchange for dead hostages?
Prisoner exchange is only one element here, and it might be the easiest element within the deal that we're negotiating. Hamas is very clear about what it wants. It said it from the very beginning, and it keeps on saying it now. They want an end to the war. They want a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. They want significantly increased humanitarian aid. They want the displaced people in Gaza to be able to return to wherever they want to return. And they want an exchange of prisoners for Israeli hostages. They are willing to give up all the hostages, dead and alive, every single one of them, according to what they say. But those are those terms. And from these months of negotiations, I would suggest that the parties involved take it seriously. Hamas says what it means and means what it says, and they negotiate on the margins, not on the main deal. And the main deal is what they're sticking to.
Gershon, what do you now anticipate will happen in the negotiations? I know this is a really tricky question, and it may be impossible to
answer. It's not so tricky because these deals are only possible when the two leaders involved here are ready to make a deal. And we have two leaders who, for their own reasons, don't want a deal. Netanyahu, prolonging the war prolongs his political lifeline because he will be out of office when this war is over. There'll be calls, massive demonstrations for new elections, and he'll have to be held accountable for his failings. And Sinwar is holding on to hostage as a life insurance policy. He'll have to end the war and come out and face the people of Gaza and see all the destruction that he brought onto Gaza. So both of these men have reasons not to want a deal, which is very difficult because the people of Israel and the people of Palestine want a deal. We have to get this war finished.
Gershon Baskin there. My thanks to him and to Jennifer Jeffries, Michael Clark and Khalil Shikaki. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Sally Abrahams and Kirsty Knight. The editor was Richard Varden and the programme was mixed by Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
None of them knew that she'd lived this double life. They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains in minus 40 degrees.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend. Helping people was in his blood.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes on BBC Sounds.
if there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life,
and all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.